several of them running up the stairs, clearing us out of the building. I stood on the street and watched as they did their work, putting out the fire. The police were there too, and an ambulance, which Sophie was sitting in the back of now, an oxygen mask clamped to her face. I felt fine, had somehow breathed in less smoke than her. "Please, God," I prayed silently, "let Edward be okay. I can't be responsible for another death. Please." My prayer was answered quickly. Within moments, he was escorted through the front door of the building by a firefighter. He sat down on a low wall, and I hurried over to him. "I'm all right," he said, waving away my concern. "The fire didn't get through the door, and I had a towel in my gym bag that I used to block out the smoke." His face darkened. "But what I want to know is who the fuck just tried to burn down my office?" He looked at me as if I could tell him the answer. The three of us were taken to the nearest hospital, where we were checked over. None of us had been burned, and although I still felt a little wheezy, the doctor told me I could go home. They wanted to keep Sophie in for the night, for observation. As I came out of the room where I was checked by the doctor, I saw Edward talking to a police officer, shaking his head. The policeman walked off, and Edward spotted me and came over. "Have they got any idea who did it?" I asked. "No. They wanted to know if I did. They want to interview me tomorrow." He rubbed his face. "I've been doing this for 15 years, and nothing like this has ever happened before. The worst I've had is an abusive phone call, and some dog shit shoved through the door by a woman who I caught shagging her yoga teacher." "Maybe they were after me," I said quietly. He studied me. "I think we should talk, Daniel. If they were after you, or were trying to stop you talking to me, this is my problem now, too. Sophie could have been killed. I could have been killed. And let's not even mention the state of my office, and the fact that everyone else in the building is now in fear of their life." I nodded. "I'm going to go and say goodbye to Sophie, see if she needs anything. Then we should go." He licked his lips. "I don't know about you, but I could bloody well do with a drink." We took a taxi to the Lord Palmerston pub, near Dartmouth Park. It was quiet at this time on a weekday afternoon. Full-time drinkers perched at the bar, and condensation clung to the windows. Edward led me over to a corner seat and fetched 2 pints of lager. He produced his notepad from his pocket. "I need you to tell me everything," he said. "I need to know what kind of people you're mixed up with, and if you don't tell me, then I'm going to have to talk to the police."
"It's okay," I said. "I want to tell you."
I took a big gulp of lager, soothing my throat.
"Come on, then. I'm waiting."
I started with the first strange incident back home, the time when somebody might or might not have tried to push Laura under a tube train. That's my girlfriend. I mean, my ex-girlfriend. "She insists she tripped," I said, "so that might not be relevant."
"It might be," he said, making a note.
Okay, so the first concrete thing that happened was when I had a break-in. I went on to tell him everything that had happened since then. Meeting Camellia at Jake's gig, my bank card being used fraudulently, the return of my laptop, Dr. Sauvage's death, though that now seemed to be unrelated, seeing somebody watching Laura in Camden, not far from where we sat now. I brought him up to date by telling him about the dog and Jake's supposed suicide. For now, I left out the part about Laura seeing ghosts and the disappearing photos. I didn't want him to think that Laura or I were crazy. "I've got a surveillance camera in my flat," I said. "It's motion-triggered." He nodded. "The video of the intruders and the dog are here on my phone." I opened the app and leaned across the table, angling the screen towards Edward. He took a pair of glasses out of his pocket and put them on, instantly making himself look 10 years older. He took the phone from me and watched the video. "I think that's her," I said. "Camellia. It looks like her body shape." He raised his eyebrows. "Any idea who the man might be?" "No, but he could be the person who firebombed your office. I wonder if he's Romanian, too." Edward tapped his notepad. "There's a huge chunk that you're still not telling me, isn't there? Like, what has Camellia's nationality got to do with it? What's your connection to Romania?" When I didn't reply straight away, he glanced down at his pad. "You haven't told me anything at all about why you think Camellia is interested in you.
What's she after?
I gave myself another second by sipping my pint. Okay, so, last summer, Laura and I went travelling around Europe. We ended up in Romania on a night train to a place called Sighișoara. Something happened. That's why I think Camelia's nationality is important.
All right, he said. Now we're getting somewhere.
I told him about meeting Alina and Ion, getting robbed in the sleeper carriage, how we were thrown off the train. He jotted down more notes, occasionally butting in with questions. Once or twice he gave me an incredulous look. I reached the point where we tried to find Alina in the forest. There was a man at the slot machine near our table, and I was paranoid that he might overhear. I waited until he wandered back to the bar. After that, I said, we ran to the nearest town and went to the police.
Hang on, he held up a hand.
What happened in the house? Suddenly it seemed very quiet in the pub.
It's obvious that you're frightened, he said, but you have to tell me, Daniel. You can take your time. I've got all afternoon.
I rotated my empty pint glass on the table, staring at the wet ring it created on the surface. I felt exactly as I would before getting up on stage in front of 1,000 people, sick and shaky. Could I do this, finally? Finally face the memories? I pictured the Molotov cocktail as it was thrown into the office, imagined a pair of hands trying to push Laura onto the tube tracks, saw the black dog leaping towards me. I had to do this.
Okay.
But let me get another drink first. And one for you. I grabbed the glasses and stood. I think you're going to need it. Part 3. Romania, August 2013. Chapter 34. I started by telling Edward what I'd already told Jake. The walk up the path to the house, going inside, looking around the entrance hall of the strange, secluded house. I told him how scared I felt, how I wanted to turn around, run. The pub seemed to vanish around us as I told him my story. The noise from upstairs. It was an unmistakable sound, even to non-parents like us. A noise that a mother or father is programmed to hear from 100 feet, through stone walls and locked doors. A baby. Crying. That was it. From that moment, I knew that we wouldn't be able to leave this place until we had discovered the source of the crying, had seen for ourselves that the baby was well and safe. It was a primal instinct. Protect the young and the helpless. Perhaps this place wasn't bad after all. Maybe it was a family home, a woodcutter with his wife and kids. A happier scenario sprouted in my imagination. The woodcutter or hunter had been out in the forest checking traps, and he had found the injured Alina. Perhaps she had stumbled into one of his traps, and he had helped her, brought her back here to ask his wife to tend to her injuries. And all these goings-on had woken the baby. That made sense, was logical. I drew strength from it. The cry came again, growing more urgent and frantic. Wherever the baby was, nobody had gone to comfort it. Laura headed towards the staircase, and I followed her. We trod as quietly as we could. The stairs were disintegrating in places, the floorboards loose and springy. I noticed something snagged on one of the steps and, looking closer, saw that it was a clump of hair. There was a window halfway up the staircase, where it turned a corner. The view was of the back of the house, and I saw with surprise that there was a narrow road that led through the trees into a backyard where a flatbed truck was parked. I had imagined that the house was only accessible through the forest. My spirits lifted a little further. We weren't completely isolated here. The road was a link to civilization. The woodcutter-hunter scenario seemed increasingly plausible. We had simply approached from the wrong angle. The baby was still crying, its sobs ebbing away before returning stronger and more urgent. Where was the mother? We reached the next floor. Like downstairs, it was in darkness, and I wondered about the source of the flickering candlelight we'd seen from outside.
It's coming from further up, Laura said in a hushed voice.
The staircase continued to another floor, and the crying was still coming from above us. I took another deep breath and urged my legs to continue. I kept following Laura up the stairs, which were even more rickety here, creaking and protesting as we headed into deeper darkness. The walls around the staircase narrowed. As we climbed, the stench of mildew and rotting animals shifted, overpowered by other odors, baby shit and human bodies. It stank like the part of a hospital where terminal patients spend their last days, sickness and death, mixed with the smell of a dirty nursery. The more positive scenario I'd dreamed up receded with every step. All I felt now was dread. We reached the top of the staircase. Before us was another wooden door with a metal latch fixed across it, the type you just need to lift to open. A lock designed to make it easy for the person going in, but impossible for the person trying to get out. The crying was coming from just behind this door. I lifted the latch and, holding my breath against the stench and the fear of what we'd find, pushed the door open. Chapter 35. I raised my eyes to gauge Edward's reaction. He was staring at me, lips parted, enrapt.
"Go on," he said.
I took another big gulp of my beer. It hurt to tell this part of the story. I thought about getting up, telling him I needed the toilet. Then I would slip out, run away like I had thought about doing back then. I hesitated for the final time, knowing how distraught Laura would be if she thought I was about to tell someone exactly what happened. I would tell him what he needed to know. On the far wall, against the windows, a number of fat white candles were lined up along the top of a pair of dark wood chests. Behind the chests, the windows were boarded up, so the light we'd seen couldn't have come from this room. I stared at the candles because they were the only thing here that made sense. Both Laura and I were paralyzed by the scene in front of us, rocked by the smell in the air, the baby's screams echoing the sound that reverberated inside me. There were four single beds and three wooden baby cots in the room. Two of the beds were empty, stripped back to reveal their thin mattresses. They looked like the beds you might see in war films, springs sagging, hard, like torture devices. The crying baby was in one of the cots, lying on its back, screaming, its face shining with tears. It waved its arms above it, clawing at the air, but was too small to roll over or sit up. On the other two beds were a pair of women. The woman in the nearest bed was asleep, or unconscious, or dead. A filthy white sheet drawn up to her waist. She was wearing a thin pink gown that revealed how malnourished she was. Her arms were like pipe cleaners, and her flat chest rose and fell jerkily as she breathed. Her head looked like a skull with stringy brown hair attached. Forcing myself to step closer, bracing myself against the acrid smell of urine and rot that emanated from her, I saw that her ankles were manacled to the foot of the bed. Laura gripped my arm as I tried to step closer, holding me back. She raised her free arm slowly and pointed at the further occupied bed. This woman was less skeletal than the first. She had blonde hair that was matted and stuck out at all angles. Her eyes were sunken, cheekbones like razors, arms skinny and weak. She was wearing a gown like the other woman, her sheet bunched up by her feet, which were also chained to the bed. Her skin was covered in bruises and tiny round scabs. Cigarette burns. She was awake, her eyes screwed tight, tears slid down her cheek, dampening her thin pillow. Shaking, I approached the bed. As I did, the baby who was in a cot close to this second bed fell quiet, like it had run out of breath and tears. Laura walked over to the cot and leaned over it, her hand shaking as she brought it to her mouth, emitting a little sob. For a moment I thought there must be something wrong with the baby, but it was in a better state than the women. It was dressed in a pale blue sleep suit and wrapped in a woolen blanket. A boy, I guessed. He had thick blonde hair, a pink face, rosebud lips. The blonde woman, his mother, opened her eyes and saw me. Panic flared in her eyes, and I braced myself, sure she would start screaming. But she stayed silent, staring at me with wide eyes, then turning her head to look at Laura. She didn't move or attempt to sit up. She whispered something, the act of doing so seemingly causing her great pain. Leaving Laura by the cot, I moved closer to the woman crouching beside her.
"I'm sorry," I said. "I don't understand. I'm English."
She gazed at me with a look of a prisoner who has been tortured, broken.
"Do you speak English?"
I asked.
"Help," she said.
I held her hand, realizing the reason she hadn't sat up was that she was too weak. To my right, Laura had lifted the baby out of the cot, was holding him against her, his head resting in the crook of her neck, one hand stroking the baby's back through the blanket he was wrapped in. The woman in the bed looked towards the baby, a mixture of love and fear in her eyes. Then her gaze flicked towards the door.
"My baby," the woman said. "Help." "Who did this to you?"
I asked in my softest voice. She stared at me. Maybe she didn't understand. She whispered something else in what I assumed to be Romanian, then spoke in English again.
"Please, baby, help."
A scream came from below us. Both Laura and I froze. The woman in the bed looked towards the door again.
"Go, baby," she said.
I looked at the door, then at Laura.
"What shall we do?"
Edward's mouth was ajar, his eyes wide. No one had ever listened to me more raptly. He was there with us in that room.
"For God's sake, you can't stop now. What did you do?"
"I..." Laura hugged the baby against her. I asked her again, "What shall we do?" I told him the rest of the story. A scream came again. My heart was banging so loudly that I was sure whoever was downstairs, whoever had done this to these women, would be able to hear it. "We have to get out," I said, answering my own question. "We'll go to town. Get help. Send the police." I turned to the woman in the bed.
"We'll send police," I said.
More tears fell from her eyes. I turned back to Laura and reached out to take the baby, to put him back in his cot. But Laura backed away, hugging the baby against her.
"He's coming with us."
"Laura, we have to leave him. We can't run through the forest with a baby. We have to get away."
"No,"
she snapped. She held the baby like he was her own, like I was threatening to take him and feed him to the lions.
"I'm not leaving him."
"Laura."
"Look, Daniel, look."
She pointed to the far side of the room, beyond the cots. A small bench was positioned against the wall. Stacked on top of this bench were items you might find in a normal nursery. Baby clothes, nappies, barrier cream, bottles, along with tubs of formula milk. There were a couple of small teddy bears, too, lying askew. Their fur was stained with something dark that looked black in the candlelight. There was something beside the bench. It was a tiny coffin, about 2 feet long. It looked like it had been built by an amateur, the angles not quite right. On top of the coffin lay a few flowers, the kind we had seen growing in the forest, along with another teddy bear. I looked back at the unconscious woman. Was her baby in there? A small part of me wanted to look, to confirm the horror, but I tore my gaze away from the coffin, catching a glimpse of something else. It was a mind-snapping moment. We both walked slowly to the wall, aware that we had to go, knowing the person or people responsible for all this could come in at any moment. Pinned to the wall were about 2 dozen Polaroid photos. Some of the photos were of women, staring at the camera lens with terror or surrender. One photo showed a woman on her back, naked, her mouth open in a scream. Beside her crouched a man, holding some kind of metal instrument, which he held between her thighs. The other photographs were of babies, newborn babies. All of them lay on their backs. Some were blue, but most were dressed in white. Some were crying, others placid, some with eyes shut, some looking towards the photographer. Each of the photos had a date inked on its white edge. The baby's date of birth, I wondered. And then I noticed. A few of the pictures had a second date added, with a large X beside it. The Polaroid in the bottom right corner had 2 dates. The first was 2/7/13, the second of July 2013. The second date read 13/8/13. The 13th of August, just a few days ago. I turned my head back towards the women on the beds. The blonde woman was weeping, the other still passed out. The baby in the coffin must be hers. It had been born here and died here in this squalid, stinking room. From downstairs the scream sounded again, a scream of pain that chilled my blood. Breathing hard, I once again spoke to the blonde woman.
"We'll be back, okay? We'll make sure your baby's safe."
She looked at me, then at the baby. I realized I might need a weapon when we got downstairs, looked around for one. I blew out one of the candles and wrenched it free of its black metal candlestick. I weighed the candlestick in my hand. It was heavy, solid. Laura was already opening the door, hesitating and peering down the stairs. I followed after her, passing the first bed. A hand shot out and grabbed my leg. I cried out, pulled away. The skeletal woman in the bed stared up at me with huge eyes, opening her mouth to reveal that most of her teeth were gone. The remaining teeth were white, healthy, suggesting that the missing teeth had been punched or pulled out. I accidentally kicked over a bedpan that sat by the bed, the foul-smelling, brownish urine slopping over the side and onto my shoe. The woman smiled at me, insanity in her eyes, and I ran, pushing Laura through the door, letting it slam shut behind us. Beneath us, the screaming had stopped. Instead, I could hear thumping. Someone coming up the stairs, very slowly. Chapter 36. "Let me go first," I said. I began to descend the stairs slowly. I stumbled on a loose stair and almost tripped, falling against the wall and managing to stay upright. We turned the corner onto the lower section of the stairwell, Laura one step behind me. The man stood at the bottom of the stairs, looking up at us. He had a gun in his hand, a black pistol, the kind that would be used by a policeman or soldier, not a farmer or hunter. He had thinning, dirty blonde hair and looked to be in his 30s, short but powerful, wiry. Behind him, at the bottom of the staircase, a woman lay face down. Black jacket and jeans, black hair streaked with red. Alina. He lifted the gun toward us, made a beckoning motion with his free hand. I didn't move, desperately trying to work out what to do. Go back up, look for another way out. He could shoot me as soon as I turned, and even if he didn't, what were the chances of finding another exit? And the thought of him hunting us through his own dark house was even worse than facing him here. I walked down the last few steps, aware that he was eyeing the candlestick. He took a couple of steps back, past the prone Alina, gesturing for us to come down into the entrance hall. We stood before him, all three of us breathing heavily. It struck me. He was nervous, too. Not as scared as Laura and me, of course, but there was definitely fear in his eyes. He turned the gun on Laura and pointed his other hand at the baby. Behind her, I could see Alina's back rising and falling. She was alive. "Mine," the man said, his words jerking my attention away from Alina. I was surprised to find that he spoke any English. He gestured for Laura to hand the boy to him. Laura didn't move. I stared at the gun, feeling the candlestick in my hand, trying to work out if I could strike him with it. At this moment, it wasn't worth the risk. "Laura," I began. "No," she said, moving towards the door. The man gestured angrily at her, at the baby, then pointed the gun towards me.
"Give the baby to me," he said.
Laura looked at the gun, then at me. "Laura," I said, "give it to him." It was her turn to look angry.
"Give me,"
the man said again, his voice a little louder, his anger growing. Laura took a step towards him, holding out the baby, and the man lowered the gun so he could take the boy. The baby started to scream, as if it knew, could sense who, what he was being handed over to. The man flinched, and Laura thrust the baby towards me, yanked the candlestick from my grasp as I took hold of the boy, and swung it at the man. He backed away, but held on to the gun, pointing it at Laura, who stood panting, clutching the candlestick tightly. I held the screaming baby, juggling it instinctively, its cries drilling into my skull.
"Put him down,"
the man shouted above the noise.
"The baby, on the floor."
Laura shouted, "No!" But what choice did I have? I stooped and laid the still screaming infant on the floor at my feet. Laura started to cry, her whole body shaking. As the man moved towards the baby, I ran for the door, grabbing Laura's arm and pulling her after me. She dropped the candlestick, and I yanked open the door, convinced a bullet would fell me at any moment. But as I risked a glance back, I saw why the shot hadn't come. Alina had got onto her hands and knees and crawled nearly to the candlestick. He was distracted by this, needed to stop her from reaching it. I pulled Laura through the door and down onto the path. She tried to struggle out of my grip. "Let me go!" she shouted. "No, Laura, for fuck's sake, let's go!" "But the baby!" She was shaking and crying and desperate to get back to the tiny boy, but I couldn't let her. "We have to get out of here. We'll get help. He'll be out here in a second." "No!" A gunshot. The baby stopped crying. I could hear screaming, and thought it was me or Laura. My senses were fucked up, muddled, but then I realized the screaming was coming from inside the house. It was Alina. "Come on, please, please, let's go!" Another gunshot, and this time Alina fell silent. We ran down the path towards the edge of the clearing. There was no time to find the road that I'd seen through the window. My heart was pounding. He was about to appear. He would shoot us both, bury us out here, and we'd never be found. Two more travellers who'd go missing in a foreign land and are never seen again. I looked back over my shoulder and saw the door of the house opening, the dark figure of the man appearing, and holding Laura's hand I ran faster than I'd ever run before, down the path, through the forest, back to the tracks. Out we came, bursting out of the trees, back onto the path, stumbling over the rail track, almost falling, one of us catching the other, stopping only to scoop up our backpacks from the edge of the forest. We ran all the way into town. We didn't talk. We didn't look back. Part 4, London, November 2013. Chapter 37. I finished my drink, immediately wishing I had another. I felt weak, drained, telling the story, reliving it again. "Daniel, hello, are you okay?" I closed my eyes. When I opened them, he was still there, waiting. There's one more thing. As we reached the trees, we heard another shot. Then another, a few seconds later. Edward thought about it, then nodded. He went upstairs and shot the two women. That's what I think. We'd seen them. He must have assumed we were going to tell the police. He wanted to remove the living evidence, although the whole place would have been full of their blood and DNA. I don't know. Maybe he decided he didn't have any use for them anymore. Like I said, I don't know. "So why didn't you go to the police?" he asked, frowning deeply. "We did. Well, we tried. We went to the local police station in Braver after running into town. I explained what had happened at the station, how we had ended up running from there too." Edward looked pale, even a little sick. He hadn't touched his pint since I'd started telling the story. He got up from the table. "I'm going to start by making some calls, doing a bit of research. I'll call you tomorrow morning, okay?" "Okay," I said. "You coming?" he asked. I shook my head. I didn't want to leave the pub. I was going to stay here and get thoroughly fucking drunk. I watched him go out through the double doors. He knew all of the story he needed to know to help me. I had done the right thing. I don't remember getting home or going to bed. The next thing I knew, it was light outside, and my mobile was ringing. The display told me it was Edward. I realized I was fully dressed, and the room smelled like a distillery. It was just after 11 in the morning, and my head was throbbing. My throat felt like I'd chain-smoked 40 cigarettes, and as I moved, a horrible wobbling nausea came over me. The phone kept ringing, and that's when it all came back to me. The Molotov cocktail, telling Edward my story, staying in the pub and getting blind drunk. Oh, Jesus. Ignoring the phone, I went into the bathroom and threw up in the toilet. After that, I felt a little better. I called Edward back. "I tried to ring you last night," he said. "Where were you?" I groped for a reply, and he said, "Never mind. I've got some stuff to tell you.
I'll come to yours. I took a shower, drank 2 cups of strong coffee, and checked my emails while I waited for Edward. There was a message from Rob.
Mate, I know you're having a tough time at the moment, but I'd really appreciate you not coming round here at midnight, banging on the door, chucking stones at Laura's window and waking Oscar up. It took 2 hours to get him back to sleep. Laura made it clear she doesn't want to see you. Personally, I think the two of you need your heads banging together, but if she says she doesn't want to be with you any more and doesn't want any contact, you need to respect that. Next time, Erin will probably call the police. And you might want to send Erin a note of grovelling apology if you want her to ever talk to you again. I really think you need to lay off the booze for a while, too. Rob.
I was mortified. What had I done when I left the pub? And why was Laura refusing to talk to me again, saying she didn't want me to contact her? I had a flash of memory that made my whole body cringe. Me, standing in Erin and Rob's back garden, lobbing pebbles at the window and shouting Laura's name like some drunken rejected Romeo. I picked up my phone and checked my texts. Fuck, I'd sent Laura over 20 messages after midnight, telling her I loved her, that I wanted to see her, asking her to marry me. She had sent a single response. Leave us alone. I went into the kitchen and took every bottle of alcohol out of the fridge and the cupboards, uncorked the wine, the smell making me gag, popping the tops from the beer bottles, and poured everything down the sink. I dropped the empties into a bin bag and carried it outside, slung it into the recycling. When I looked up, Edward was walking towards me, hands in pockets, head down.
"Everything all right?" he asked when he saw me.
"I'm never drinking again," I said.
"Get rat-arsed, did you, after I left?"
I nodded, leading him inside.
"I have to admit, I felt like getting pissed too after that story you told me, but instead I spent the evening working, after dealing with the bloody insurance company, that is. Somebody needs to send them into a house of horror in the woods."
Seeing my expression, he said, "Sorry, shouldn't even joke about it. I had a nightmare last night, the first I've had in years. Firebombs and women chained to beds and babies crawling through the flames," he shuddered. "Then I had the police round first thing, asking lots of questions about who might want me dead."
"What did you tell them?"
"I told them I have no idea. But they are going to want to talk to you." He handed me a card. "Here, this is the investigating officer's number." A great wave of exhaustion washed over me as I took the card. I was going to have to talk to the police. It was all going to come out, everything that had happened. I set the card aside. "I'll talk to them later. First, I need to know what you found out. Make me a very strong coffee, and I'll tell you." As I waited for the kettle to boil, Edward paced the room, running a finger along the spines of books, peeking through the curtains at the street, like he was looking out for someone. I carried 2 coffees over, and he sat on the sofa while I pulled up a chair.
"I have to say, Daniel, the story you told me sounded like just that, a story."
"But it's the truth." He held up a palm. "All right, I'm not saying I don't believe you. The thing is, from what I found out last night, it gets even weirder." I waited for him to continue, dreading what I was going to hear. "So, after talking to you last night, I went to see this guy who recently did some work for me, a translator. He speaks all the Eastern European languages, including Romanian. He's a bit of a paranoid nutcase, but he's useful. I got him to call the police in Brava to act as an interpreter." I was horrified.
"You told this interpreter what had happened?"
"Daniel, please listen, if you keep interrupting." He gave me a smile that was intended to be reassuring. "I asked to speak to the policeman you told me you saw, Constantine. I wanted to check out what you told me."
"What? But I was sure he was involved."
"Daniel, for fuck's sake. I needed to check it out, that's all. It's standard practice. I'd be a pretty shit investigator if I took everything I heard as gospel. Because we need to find out if this Camellia person is connected to what you saw."
"Okay, makes sense."
A fist clenched and unclenched in my stomach. "So, I asked to speak to Constantine, or rather my interpreter did. The Brava police were really evasive at first,
wanted to know why we were calling them, where we were ringing from, etc. So I told them I was following up on a crime that had been reported back in August, and they eventually put me through. But not to Constantine, to another officer. He looked on the system, told me they had no record of an English couple coming in and reporting a crime.
Edward's phone began to vibrate. He glanced at the screen and dismissed the call.
Where was I? Oh, yeah. This police officer told me they had no record of any such report, that they get very few English people coming to Brava, apart from the occasional loser looking for vampires or werewolves. Did you know Brava is famous for werewolf sightings? I looked it up on Google. I shook my head. Anyway, I asked again if I could speak directly to Constantine.
And did you get to talk to him?
Edward looked at me over the rim of his coffee cup.
No. Constantine has gone missing. Nobody has seen him for 2 weeks.
Have they got any idea what's happened to him?
They wouldn't tell me, but it didn't seem like it.
What else did you tell them?
I told them what you told me about the house, and what you'd seen, an abbreviated version of it anyway.
I had no idea how to feel about this.
What did they say?
To say they were sceptical would be an understatement. I mean, I was talking through an interpreter, and he was looking at me like I'd lost my mind.
So the interpreter does know, he tutted.
But I eventually got them to promise to go and take a look in the forest, to find the house. I tried to put the idea in their heads that they might find Constantine there, which, who knows, might actually be true.
I stood up, strode across the room and back again. My legs were trembling.
I haven't heard back yet, he continued. I assume they were waiting till today, so they could go when it was light. I'm waiting for the Brava police to ring me back.
Anxiety was coming off me in waves.
Edward said, listen, don't worry about the police in Romania. They'll find the house. Maybe there are women being held prisoner there right now. At the very least, there must be evidence of the crimes that took place. The guy who did this will finally be stopped.
You have a lot of faith in the police.
He shrugged.
Maybe. Anyway, while we're waiting to hear, I want to go through everything else you told me, okay?
Okay.
Good. Got any paper? Or are you one of those people who only has screens?
I grabbed a few sheets from my printer, and he spread them out on the table between us.
Okay, he said. We're going to write down all the questions, all the things that don't make sense, and then we're going to answer them as best we can. See if we can make this puzzle fit together.
Between us, we spent the next 20 minutes writing out these questions in block capitals and sorting the sheets of paper into order. Apart from our voices, it was silent in the flat, so quiet you could hear the hum of the electrics, the creaking radiators, the occasional voice from the street below. It felt good to do this, better than tapping out the list of problems on my phone. I felt a growing sense of gratitude towards Edward, wished I'd found someone to help me like this earlier. I was able to push my anxiety about my drunken visit to Laura and her messages and what the police in Brava would find to the back of my mind while we worked on this task. It reminded me of the nights when I would sit up working on my app, problem-solving, everything else in the world fading to grey while I concentrated on the puzzle before me. At one point, I heard the sound of tyres skidding on the road outside, the thump of a car door, but I was concentrating too hard on what I was doing to look out of the window. After we'd filled each sheet with text, Edward sat back and surveyed them, rubbing a forefinger back and forth across his chin.
Right, he said. Let's see what we've got.
The top left sheet of paper contained the words, "What was Camellia looking for?"
First of all, Edward said, we don't know if Camellia is connected to the events near Brava. We assume she is, because she's Romanian, but that could be a coincidence.
It can't be, I said.
But we can't assume.
If you say when you assume you make an ass out of you and me, I'm going to fire you.
You definitely didn't meet or see her while you were over there, he asked.
No, definitely not. I'd recognize her. She's a very memorable girl.
Hmm. She certainly sounds it. Now, tell me exactly what Camellia said to you on both occasions you met.
I recounted our conversations as well as I could remember them.
So, the first time you met her, she asked if you'd ever had a bad experience with Romanian women.
And when I said I hadn't,
She asked if I was sure.
Fuck, I exhaled. And the second time she kept asking me if I'd done anything illegal, broken the law, over and over.
Trying to get you to confess to something you don't know about.
We did break the law, I said, sitting up straight, going into that sleeper carriage without a ticket. Maybe she was trying to get me to tell her about that.
Daniel, that's hardly stealing the crown jewels, is it?
It can't be that.
He thought about it.
Let's assume that it definitely was Camellia on that CCTV video, and that she was responsible for the burglary, too.
When she came into your flat, she ransacked the place the first time, didn't she?
Look, she was looking for something.
Yes.
Edward went back to scrutinizing the sheet of paper, as if the answer was hiding between the words.
Let's think. We're pretty sure she's broken into your flat 3 times, her and whoever she's working with.
Once to ransack the place, and steal your laptop, then to bring the laptop back, and then when they came back with the dog.
He rubbed his chin again.
If they were searching for something, it makes sense that they turned your flat over, but why bring the laptop back? And why come back with a dog?
Because they wanted to hurt me. They thought the dog would kill me.
My whole body went cold as I said these words. Edward went quiet for a few minutes, then looked at me.
Let's come back to that. I just need to...
He trailed off.
How did Camellia get the key to your flat?
I have no idea. I haven't lost any keys.
What about Laura? Has she had any keys go missing?
I... Hang on.
Yes. When we got back to the UK, Laura didn't have her keys.
We thought they'd probably gone missing at some point on our trip.
But the thief who took our passports must have taken them.
That never crossed your mind before?
No. There was a lot going on in our heads when we got back. It didn't even cross our minds that the person who robbed us would take the keys to our flat.
Well, at least that explains how they got into your flat.
And makes it seem even more likely that Camellia is connected to what happened on the train, to the theft.
Well, maybe she was on the train. She or her partner in crime.
They took your keys... so they could come over here and rob your flat.
I shook my head.
That seems a bit unlikely. Travel all across Europe to rob a flat. And why wait 3 months?
Plus it doesn't explain all the questions.
And they brought the most valuable stolen item back anyway. Why?
I thumped my forehead.
None of it makes sense. Oh, I need another coffee.
I went into the kitchen and filled the kettle. Made 2 more mugs of instant coffee. I'd bought Nescafe again. Jake would be looking down now, shaking his head and muttering about baby milk. As I waited for the kettle to boil, Edward's mobile rang. He looked up at me.
It's a call from Romania. The police.
Chapter 38 Laura had paced the strip of carpet between the bed and window in her room at Erin and Rob's so many times now that she was surprised it hadn't worn away to reveal the floorboards. As she paced, she chewed the skin around her fingernails, sucking the blood from her thumb, pacing, chewing, sucking, pacing. She had a word stuck in her head, putrescent. She didn't know why or where it had come from, but it repeated over and over, putrescent, putrescent, putrescent. Pace, chew, suck, pace, back and forth, up and down, round and round and round. She forced herself to stop, gulped down air, resisted her fingers as they called to her, urging her to bite them, shred them, make them bleed. She leaned her head against the cool glass of the window, imagined she could feel the rain that beat against it, caressing her forehead, cooling her fevered brow, sure that she could smell her own rotting skin. Putrescent. And aware of the thump, thump, thump of her heart. Last night she had lain sweating beneath the sheets, like she often did just before she got her period, but this increased heartbeat, the shivering fear and unease that coursed through her, was worse than ever. Worse than in the first nights after she'd seen the dying women at that house, before she'd heard the gunshots that killed them and Alina. Killed the baby, the poor, innocent, sweet, big-eyed baby. She took a deep, shuddering breath. She could hear little Oscar downstairs, crying, could hear the voices of Erin and Rob and the couple who were visiting them, a woman Erin worked with and her husband. This woman, Laura didn't know her name, was putrescent too. No, pregnant too, pregnant. And Laura touched her own belly, wondering if she'd ever have a baby of her own. If she did, she would keep him or her sequestered away, give him or her the perfect life, unlike hers. The baby would be her clean slate, and she would keep her son or daughter safe from hands that meant harm, safe from ghosts, safe from the old man. She had seen him again yesterday. She was sure he wasn't a ghost, too. He was real, all too real. He had been sitting in a shiny black car parked across the road, watching the house. It was the kind of car the devil drives in movies, the kind that pulls up at a crossroads on a highway in the middle of nowhere, inviting the hapless runaway to get in, offering a deal, a one-way ride to hell. She knew, even if she was losing her mind, that she was letting her imagination run riot, that there was no devil who drove around in a black BMW offering rides to doomed mortals. But the old man was real. When he saw Laura approaching, he fired up the engine and drove away, the car gliding silently up the street, slipping out of sight. Laura had been stuck to the spot. Again, she was sure she had seen him before. Last night, when she'd finally entered a choppy, troubled sleep, the answer had come to her, shrouded by symbolism, and though she had grasped the meaning in the nightmare, when she woke up among cold, wet sheets, she couldn't recall it. She had told Alina about the old man, the devil, and the ghost had turned even paler, if such a thing was possible. Then she'd said, "Don't worry, I'll deal with him when he comes." Alina had slipped away before Laura could ask what the dead woman meant. Now she opened her eyes and looked down at the spot where Daniel had stood last night, calling her name. She couldn't face him, couldn't bear to talk to him. It broke her heart to see him walk away. She wanted to run after him. More than that, she wanted to run so fast that she could stop time, turn the planet back like Superman, and erase everything that had happened since last August. Change what had happened in that house. Then she and her Danny would still be together, still be happy. She realized her face was wet, that she was crying. "Go and see him," a voice said. "Talk to him." She found a tissue and blew her nose, rubbed her eyes. Was there any chance they could make it work? Even now? Downstairs, Oscar was crying, shrieking, and the sound penetrated Laura's skull, made it impossible to think straight. She needed to get out. She grabbed her coat and, scrutinizing the garden once more to see if Alina was there, but not seeing her, headed out. Now, 30 minutes later, she walked along the street where she'd lived not so long ago. The snow had been washed away by the rain, leaving a few patches of slush in the gutters, the odd frozen clump clinging to a hedge. Her legs had brought her here, despite her head's protestations. All the way she kept thinking, "I'll stop soon, I'll go back, in a minute." But she couldn't stop walking. And now here she was. She had been happy here, had enjoyed such good times. Tears pricked her eyes again, and she was almost overwhelmed by regret. If only! As she approached the building where Daniel lived, she heard a noise and turned. The devil? But it was just a fox, padding away from her across the road. A pretty fox. It stopped in the middle of the road and turned its face towards her. At that moment, a silver car, old, battered, the opposite of the shining black vehicle driven by the old man, screeched around the corner and barreled towards the fox. Laura gasped as the car skidded to a halt, closing her eyes, certain she would hear the impact of metal against bone. When she opened them, the fox was gone. Under the wheels? She ran into the road, trying to see, ready to shout at the woman behind the wheel of the battered car, a woman who was staring at her, a smile on her face. What was so funny? The car door opened, and a blonde woman with chunky silver rings on her fingers got out. "Laura," she said. She had the same accent as Alina. "Yes? Who are you? Get in the car." "What?" The woman produced a knife from beneath her coat.
Get in the car.
Chapter 39. Edward murmured into the phone, facing away from me, so I couldn't really hear what he was saying. The police in Braver must have found someone who spoke English, as Constantine had been able to do. I was desperate to hear what Edward was saying, attempted to get in front of him, but he kept turning away from me, shooting me irritated looks until I gave up. The call ended.
"Well," I said, "have they been to the house? What did they find?"
He ran a finger across his eyebrow.
"Nothing." "For God's sake, tell me what they said."
He held his hand out and waited for me to hand him his coffee. I was tempted to chuck it at him.
"They found the house, but said it was deserted."
"What?
You mean, like no one lived there?"
"Exactly. He said that the whole place was empty. No food in the cupboards, a single rusty bed in what would have been the master bedroom, with a bare mattress. No plates in the kitchen or mugs, certainly no sign of Constantine."
He sipped his coffee and winced.
"One weird thing. One of the bedrooms on the top floor appeared to have been decorated recently. It still had that fresh paint smell, but it was completely empty. They found some furniture in one of the rooms, some chests, a dresser, a few ancient chairs draped with sheets."
So he's gone, and covered up the evidence.
I swore under my breath, though to be honest, I hadn't been expecting the police to find anything. In a way, I was pleased. I wanted that place, any traces of what I'd seen there, to be wiped from the face of the earth. Of course, I wanted justice for those women, for Alina, for the babies who had died, but the possibility of that seemed so remote. Part of me wanted to hear the place had been burned to the ground. It was a place of evil, and this world would be better without it. Edward continued.
"I asked him if there was any record of who lived there. He said the last resident, according to their equivalent of the land registry, was a woman who died in 1991. The place has been empty for over 20 years.
"Except it hasn't.
I want to talk to Laura," he said.
"Why?"
"Because I want to see if she's been experiencing the same kind of things that you have, and, well, I want to check her version of events."
I stared at him, the anger which had drained from me in the kitchen simmering again.
"You think I'm making the whole thing up?"
"No, don't be stupid. I want to see if Laura remembers anything that you don't. Like, maybe she saw Camellia on the train. Maybe Laura has had contact with Camellia, too, in the last couple of weeks."
"Oh, my God, you're right.
What's Laura's address?" I told him, and he wrote it down in his notepad. I said,
"Maybe it was Camellia who tried to push Laura under the tube train."
"Oh, Jesus!
I bet she killed Jake!"
"Camellia? But why would she do that?"
"Because she must have known I'd talk to him, and she went after him for information about whatever the hell it is she's looking for, thinking I might have told him and
had to kill him, so he wouldn't tell me that she'd been to see him.
Or maybe she murdered him because she was so angry with him, because he didn't have the info she needed."
I paused.
"And the only reason she hasn't tried to kill me is that she thinks I'll still lead her to what she's after."
"But she did try to kill you, didn't she? The dog?"
"Maybe she was just trying to scare me."
"I don't know, Daniel. It doesn't make sense. Would a skinny, slight woman like Camellia be able to overpower Jake?"
"She would only have to catch him off balance to be able to push him off that bridge. And we know she's not working alone. It was probably the man on the video, both of them. This is all even more reason to talk to Laura. But she refuses to see me. I can't go anywhere near her."
He gave me a wry smile. "Who said anything about you coming too?"
Chapter 40.
The blonde woman didn't speak at all on the way to wherever it was they were going. She glanced at Laura in the rear-view mirror whenever they stopped at a traffic light. Laura had tried to open the door, but the child locks were on. When Laura tried to talk, to ask the woman who she was, what she was doing, she found that her voice box didn't work. Not just that, but all the words in her head had vanished, all but one. Putrescent, 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 putrescent.
"Stop fucking doing that!"
the woman snapped, shattering the silence. Laura's eyes swiveled towards her.
"Biting your fingers! Stop it!
Putrescent, 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 putrescent. Laura sat on her hands. The woman cursed.
This traffic!
Laura forced herself to get a grip, to start noticing things. She might need these details later. The driver was Eastern European, very pretty. She smelled of cigarettes. Her roots were poking through. She wore silver rings. She crunched the gears whenever she turned a corner and shifted down to second. The urge to pull her hands out from beneath her and start chewing them again was almost overwhelming. What else? The car was a Skoda, the type favoured by minicab drivers, and seemed pretty old, but not too old to have child locks. There was a rip in the upholstery beside her, and they were driving east, through Islington, up Essex Road, and now they were in Hackney. Victoria Park wasn't far from here. They kept going, stopping and starting, got stuck behind a bus for a long time, skirted the edges of Hackney Marshes. Now they were in East London proper. Leighton squatting dejectedly beneath the colourless winter sky, and soon they pulled up in a quiet back street outside a house beside a vacant shop. The house had a boarded-up door and a front garden that was so badly overgrown that it was spilling onto the street. The blonde got out, came round and opened the passenger door, poking the knife towards Laura. Out! She led Laura round the back of the house, where the garden was even more jungle-like than at the front. The back door had several broken glass panes. The woman stuck her hand through the jagged hole and opened the door from the inside. Again, she jabbed the knife at Laura and told her to go inside. Laura thought about running, trying to escape, but for the second time that day, her legs wouldn't obey her brain. I'm going to die, she thought, and she found that she didn't feel scared. Death, she decided, would not be unjust. It was dark inside the house. It smelled of something rotting, putrescent, and the light fittings were empty. The woman led her into a boxy living room. Black bin liners covered the windows, so it was pitch dark inside. "Where the fuck is he?" the woman muttered, and Laura's heart lurched. "He? Who was he?" "The devil," a voice whispered in her head. Now she was scared. Swearing under her breath, the blonde used her mobile to cast faint light into the room, searching through the drawer of a cabinet until she found what she was looking for. Two candles and a box of matches. She's not holding the knife on me now, Laura realized. This would be the perfect time to run. But yet again, her legs wouldn't do what she wanted. She was too transfixed by her surroundings. This place, the smell, the candles, the old dark wood furniture, it was like that house. The evil house. The woman turned to her, wearing a cruel smile. "Well, it looks like it's just you and me, Laura. Men, they are so fucking useless." She laughed bitterly and pointed the knife at Laura, gesturing at a sofa that looked like it had been rescued from a rubbish dump. "Sit." Laura managed to speak. "Who are you? What do you want?" "I just want to ask you a question," the woman responded. There was a fake Prada bag on the floor, and the woman crouched and opened it, producing a pair of handcuffs. She yanked Laura's shoulder and pulled her around, then snapped the cuffs over her wrists. "You won't be able to bite your fingers now," she said. She pointed the tip of the blade at Laura's face. "Listen to me, and don't speak. I am going to ask you a question. You are going to tell me the truth. If you don't, I will hurt you. Very badly." She took hold of Laura's sweater and yanked it upwards, revealing her bra. "I will slice off your nipples. I will cut out your eyes. I will fucking circumcise you." Laura was too terrified to speak. "You've seen worse," she told herself. "You can get through this. Talk to her. Reason with her. She's a woman. She'll let you go." But just like her treacherous legs, her tongue wouldn't work. "But if you answer," the woman said, "if you tell the truth, you can leave this place in one piece, okay?" It was freezing in the room, but Laura could feel sweat running down her back and something wet on her cheeks, too. Tears. She was crying silently. "Okay, here is the question. When you returned from Romania, you had two backpacks with you. Where are they? And what did you do with the contents?" Laura stared at the woman,
unsure if she had heard the question correctly.
Backpacks?
Sighing, the woman pulled Laura's sweater up again and stuck the knife down beneath her bra, between the cups, the flat edge cold against Laura's skin. She pulled, and the knife sliced through the fabric. The bra fell open, exposing her breasts.